This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's show. If you haven't liked us on Facebook and Twitter yet, go do that, because I got some announcements I'm going to be coming up with about the show in the next few weeks. Some of you might be interested in. So, that's usually how I get stuff out. I post stuff to the Facebook page, I post to Twitter, and if you follow us on there, you'll get to know more about what's going on. And for tonight, I have quite a treat for you. We have Robert Sullivan with us, who has written a couple of books, The Royal Arch of Enoch and Cinema Symbolism. And we're going to bring Robert in right now.
Great to be with you. Great to be here tonight on your show, Where Did the Road Go? And thanks for having me on.
All right. So you have two books out, The Royal Arch of Enoch and Cinema Symbolism. And you're working on Cinema Symbolism 2. And I get the impression the Cinema Symbolism books came out of The Royal Arch of Enoch.
Well, that's right. The Royal Arch book is this book about Masonic history that presented this historical anomaly. And to make a long story short, the last chapter of the Royal Arch of Enoch book, I wanted to bring it up to modern times. So the book concluded with talking about what you would call like Masonic solar hidden themes in movies. Some of the movies I delved into were like National Treasure, Da Vinci Code, things like that. There's much more buried beneath the surface in those movies. And I was seeing the same sort of symbolism and themes going on in other movies, not necessarily Masonic per se, but just hidden themes and hidden mythology. And I just really wanted to continue on with this. So when I got done with Royal Arch of Enoch, that came out actually over now 3 years ago. I started in on Cinema Symbolism, and that came out about a year ago. And it was just sort of this continuation of this final chapter from Royal Arch of Enoch, talking about these hidden mythological, esoteric, arcane themes in popular movies. And you're absolutely correct. There was so many of them. That as I was doing Cinema Symbolism, there were other movies I wanted to even, you know, more talk about, but it, you know, the book would have just gone on and on forever. So Cinema Symbolism came out, and I'm working on Cinema Symbolism 2 right now.
So why are these themes in these movies? I mean, is it an intentional thing, or is it just some kind of subconscious influence?
Yeah, you can look at it. You know, it's an interesting question. I believe in 99% of the time, it's completely intentional. I believe these filmmakers are definitely doing this. It was clearly enough to convince me that this was beyond coincidence. And just some movies are just really, you know, overloaded with a lot of this material, where you're well beyond, you know, this being a coincidence at this point. So it was to me, it was definitely intentional. Why to do this is the easiest way I can explain this in a condensed amount of time is it's the same sort of idea, same principle, as an architect incorporating sacred geometry into a building. It may not be visible to your naked eye, but it's definitely going to affect you, and you're definitely going to pick up on it in one form or another. It's the same thing here. It's really modern-day mythology making. And by placing this stuff beneath the celluloid, it allows the filmmaker to sort of tap into this ancient stream and reservoir of arcane themes and mythology that is very powerful. You're dealing with things related to the collective unconscious, symbols, mythology, ancient religions, astrology, alchemy, Kabbalah, that our unconscious mind, you know, somewhat hooked on. And by placing it in there, it's really turning a movie into modern-day mythology. So, you could talk a couple times where maybe it's coincidental, things like that. But in doing this book, it really struck me just as to the, you know, detail, the attention to detail some of these filmmakers use, that this was well beyond coincidence, and it was definitely being intentionally done.
All right. I think one of the more obvious ones that follows this type of stuff is The Matrix.
Oh, absolutely. That is the three Matrix movies, and especially the first one, is definitely one of those movies where you watch and you really start to break this thing down. You will definitely know that there is an underlying theme going on in that movie. And the three Matrix movies, and it's really the first one, is what I would say is really, if you want to see the Gnostic religion on film, if you want a tutorial in Gnosticism proper, I would definitely say the first Matrix movie is really everything you're looking for. Just for instance, you have Neo as sort of this Gnostic savior who's going to awaken mankind from the illusion of the material world. This is the creation of the false reality within the Gnostic religion, which is called, you know, which is created by this lesser god called the Demiurge. This character turns up in The Matrix Part 2, known as the Architect, the creator of this false material world. So you have Neo Anderson. I mean, you just have so much subliminal and suggestive symbolism going on in this. And you have, you know, Neo. He gets introduced that this world is a false illusion. This gets introduced to him by Trinity, of all things, and this of course ties into the idea of the sacred feminine, which in the Gnostic religion was Sophia, which was part of their sacred Trinity. So you have Trinity as the sacred feminine. She leads him into this, you know, quasi what you would call, like, you know, esoteric temple. He goes up the staircases, to meet with this wizard-like character known as Morpheus. Very interesting name to give to this guy. Morpheus in mythology is the god of sleep and dreams, yet it's Morpheus who's going to bring Neo out of the dreamlike stasis, bring him into the real world. Then you have this whole thing with the red and blue pill. He takes the red pill, and then you have this Alice in Wonderland homage where he goes through the looking glass, wakes up in the real world, gets flushed down the toilet by the machines, and is ultimately lifted cruciform like Jesus up into the light, into the belly of the ship. And then you just have these, I could go on and on. I mean, this could literally consume the rest of the show. but you have Neo being presented as this Christ-like savior who is ultimately killed and resurrected. And even at the end of it, he ascends into the heavens at the very end of the Matrix movie. So you have this, you know, I mean, at one point in time, you have the whole idea of in the Gnostic religion, these group of fallen angels called the Archons, who are sort of the enforcers of the Demiurge. These are the agents led by Smith in the Matrix movie. And then even at one point where Neo's on the bridge of the ship, you get a brief hint at the nameplate of the Nebuchadnezzar, which is, it says Mark 3:11, and that's of course a biblical reference to Mark 3:11, which, and I'm just paraphrasing, says something off the top of, you know, something to the effect of, "Thou art the Son of Man, Thou art the Son of God, and all demons and dark forces bow down before you." So it's this whole idea of Neo being this Gnostic savior who's going to awaken mankind from this slumbering stasis, awaken him to the illusion of the material world, and basically bring about esoteric wisdom, and bring him into the reality, this fault, you know, show him the false world, and bring him into this new level of consciousness, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So yeah, the other three movies definitely get into this as well, or the other two, but the first Matrix movies, just loads of Gnosticism and esoteric symbolism, and that is definitely a movie that is overloaded with esoteric themes and symbolisms, no question about it.
Yeah, and there's also a weird 9/11 reference in there too.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You have in the very first Matrix movie, it's interesting, you see a lot of videos on YouTube talking about, you know, 9/11 being prophesied. I mean, some of this stuff goes back 20 years. I don't buy into that. But The Matrix did come out in 1999, and I mean, of all things, to have a 9/11 reference, and it's the whole date. It is disturbing. I certainly can't account for it. It's definitely incredibly hard to explain. It's Neo's passport. It's the interrogation scene when he's being interrogated by Smith. towards the beginning of the movie. If you have the Blu-ray and you pause it, you can find it online. You can find the screen cap online. Neo Anderson's passport actually expires on September 11th, 2001. And it's a hell of a date to pick. In light of the fact of what that movie's about sort of the death and resurrection of the old world, you know, the kind of the idea of stripping away of the old and the birth of the new. And you'll actually find another esoteric reference on this that is sort of ties into this Gnostic idea of dualism, which is we have the Neo's expiration date on the passport expiring on 9/11. His birth date is actually has hidden meaning as well. I want to say off the top of my head, I think it's September 13th, 1971, which is his birth date. That is a reference to the date of that is the date of the suppression of the Attica prison riots. In New York State, where the governor sent in the National Guard to suppress the prison riots. So the idea is, the dualistic meaning is, you have the suppression of the prison riots, the put down of the prisoners on this date, yet it's the birthday of the one, the chosen one, Neo, who's going to free or liberate mankind from the prison-like stasis that is the Matrix. So you have this whole idea of the suppression of the prisoners on that date, yet it's Neo who's also born, who's going to liberate mankind from the prison matrix condition that he finds himself in. Very dualistic, very Gnostic. Again, ton going on in the Matrix movie.
Now, could the 9/11 date have some other meaning to it that was not related, obviously, to the terrorist attack that would have caused them to put that in there?
I sure as hell can't think of any that I could come up with off the top of my head. I don't know, you know, why that's going in there. I mean, I guess if you want to just, you know, look at it as a sort of thing, okay, maybe just this one time it turned up as a coincidence. Certainly it would be hard for me to kind of sit on the show and justify how the Wachowski brothers, or I guess I should say at this point in time, Wachowski siblings,
right,
you know, became aware of that. I've been asked this question before about this. And, you know, this is sort of what you've hinted at the, you know, with your first question is, you know, when you get into this whole idea of Carl Jung, the famous psychiatrist, the collective unconscious, things that are inherent to all of our natures, and things that these themes lay buried in our minds collectively, you get into the whole idea then is, could the collective unconscious also be not only inherited, could it somehow be predictive? And you know, by putting this, by having future events turn up in movies, you know, with movies being a prophetic device, is this somehow sort of the collective unconscious being predictive? That's certainly possible. I don't claim to be an expert on this, and it's certainly an outside the box way of thinking. It's certainly possible. I've never really studied it. It's something I'm talking about briefly in the Cinema Symbolism 2 book that I'm working on right now. It's a fascinating idea, the whole notion of movies being predictive, being prophecy, because there's clearly instances of this, and in some instances it's completely intentional because the filmmakers have come out and said so. But in other cases, that doesn't seem to be the case, and so how do you account for it? You can look at it as, okay, it's just a straight coincidence. They make so many movies that they just got it right this one time. Or you get into the whole idea of, okay, if movies are somehow tapping into, as a creative expression, are tapping into this Jungian collective unconscious, well, then would it be fair also to say that they can be predictive as well? Fascinating idea. I certainly wouldn't rule it out by any stretch.
And I think it's fascinating that it's in a movie like The Matrix, where there's like no accidental symbology in there. It's all very specific and aimed, and you know, it's all very intentional.
Oh, I totally agree with you, and that's what makes it so disturbing. No question about it. I know a lot of times, you know, and I've seen the YouTube videos where, you know, okay, if you pause this, you know, image from this movie from the 1980s, and you stand on your head looking in a mirror while spitting nickels, you know, you can see two buildings on fire or something. Oh,
right.
And this is not. I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't buy into any of that. But alternatively, I mean, that is, you know, it's like you said, when you're dealing with the Matrix movie, you know, you have so many themes going on in that thing. I mean, that is clearly one. I mean, just another one, like, for example, Neo at the beginning. I mean, this this turns up a couple times in the movie and has different meanings each time, is in Neo at the beginning of it, this is the first Matrix, he's in apartment room 101. And that's no accident either. 101 is binary, I want to say, for the number 6. And of course, Neo turns out to be the 6th iteration of the 1. So that's intentional. And then you'll find it again in the second Matrix movie, where the Merovingian is on floor 101 in the high rise. And that's also intentional. That taps into George Orwell's 1984, in the Ministry of Love, where all of man's fears and anxieties are explored in room 101. And that's, of course, what the Merovingian does. He's the keeper of all the rogue programs, the ghosts, the goblins, the fear programs that are, of course, man's distresses. So that's also intentional. So, yeah, I mean, to find a 9/11 reference in a movie that is overloaded with this stuff anyway, I totally agree with you. It's definitely disturbing.
All right, let's talk about someone else who has loaded his movies down with symbolism, that being Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, absolutely. The Kubrick movies are a fascinating study. I touch on them briefly in Cinema Symbolism, mainly The Shining. I touched on it briefly in Cinema Symbolism. I'm delving into it much more in depth in Cinema Symbolism 2. And then, of course, you get into the whole, you know, the Illuminati, film, Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
This to me is completely intentional. Kubrick was a master filmmaker, The Shining is a classic, for veiled symbolism and themes. And we could get, I'm familiar with the whole moon landing idea also. I'm not sure if I'm 100% willing to buy into that yet, but I certainly can talk about it. With The Shining, I can start with that if you like.
Sure.
You have the whole notion with this comes from a documentary called Room 237, and the idea is that when Kubrick put out Dr. Strangelove and 2001: A Space Odyssey, the government saw this and was very impressed with his cinematic techniques in both these movies, especially in 2001, of the people moving around in these in anti-gravity. I mean, they were very impressed with how Kubrick filmed this. And then, of course, in 69, they go to the moon. And the idea is, whether or not they actually went to the moon or not, is open to debate. But the idea was, well, they couldn't take a film production company with them to the moon, so they filmed that footage of Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong jumping around on the lunar surface, which is actually inside a studio, and that the guy who actually shot this is none other than Stanley Kubrick. Hmm. And this turns up in all places of the Shining movie. And there does seem to be something to this. The idea is, again, that the government saw 2001, were impressed with the anti-gravitational scenes, and if you watch them, they actually look very similar to the guys, jumping around on the moon. Well, of course, the scene in The Shining is when the little boy's playing with the toys, and he's got them arranged. He's playing in the hallway, and he's got them arranged the way it would look like a launch pad. And the little ball comes rolling in, and then he stands up with the Apollo 11 sweater on, and this is, of course, symbolizing the rocket launch. I've watched that scene 1,000 times, and it does. I mean, that little boy, Danny Lloyd, definitely stands up with a purpose. That is definitely something that, Kubrick is drawing your attention to that. It's not just him standing up. I mean, he stands up with authority. The idea is that this is a rocket launch. Then the little boy, Danny, goes to room 237, and, of course, this is where the female ghoul, or evil spirit is. In the book, in Stephen King's book, I believe it's room 213, Kubrick changed it, and there's a couple reasons why he changed it. It has numerological symbolism, which we could talk about in a minute, but he changes it to room 237, and King asked Kubrick why he changed this, and Kubrick just blew him off. He just shrugged it off his artistic license. It's interesting because in the late 1970s and 1980, the moon was approximately 237,000 miles from the Earth, so you have the little boy and the Apollo 11 sweater going to, you know, 237, which is journeying to the moon, essentially. So the whole idea behind this is that Kubrick is symbolically showing you that he was the guy behind filming the film that of the guys jumping around on the moon surface. That's the theory behind it anyway. It's interesting. I could tell you right now, just, you know, studying The Shining, that this is another one of those movies that is just over, and this ties in also, I mean, I know Kubrick's doing this because it ties into the Eyes Wide Shut movie as well, where there is these very hidden dark themes going on inside The Shining, which are completely intentional, and I mean, I can certainly delve into it if you want me to. If you want to just with The Shining, you have a very alchemical storyline going on. In fact, you could craft an argument. King hated Kubrick's vision of The Shining.
Yeah.
He I don't think King fully understood it. You know, King wrote a ghost story, and that's not at all what Kubrick presents on the screen. You have this very alchemical movie of this guy Torrance going from sort of this sort of failed writer to a full blown psychopath. But then what Kubrick really does in The Shining is he embeds this thing with repetition, namely numbers that repeat over and over again, to symbolize the vicious reincarnation, this endless reincarnation cycle going on inside the Overlook Hotel. So I'll just delve into this real quick. For example, you have the movie opening with Torrance. And it's repetition. It's endless repetition. He's driving on the road to the Overlook. That road that he's driving on is actually called the Going to the Sun Road, and it was built in 1921, and that's exactly where the movie ends. It ends in 1921 with the photo on the wall, of the ball, the 4th of July ball in 1921. So the movie starts where it ends. Robert Zemeckis does the same exact trick in the Back to the Future movies. And then the number 21 is something that repeats again. If you pay attention to the end of the movie, it's the photos are in rows of it's three rows and seven photos, so 21. When Torrance arrives at the Overlook, he tells the person it took 3.5 hours to get there. That's 210 minutes, 21 again. If you take the number 21 and multiply it times 2, you get the number 42. This repeats. You will find the number 42 on Scatman Crothers' license plate at the end of the movie. Danny Torrance wears a T-shirt that has the number 42 at the beginning of it when he's eating breakfast. And the movie they watch, believe it or not, when Shelley Duvall and the little boy are watching the movie in the Overlook, that's the summer of 42. So we have this repetition. And if you actually take the numbers 237 and you multiply them, you get the number 42. And if you add them up, you get the number 12. That's a number that repeats over and over. The name of the hotel is KDK-12. Jack Torrance throws the ball against the wall 12 times. They take 12 turns in the hedge maze. And I'm just scratching the surface with this. It's a whole study. I've got about a 30-page portion of this in Cinema Symbolism 2, talking about the repetition going on in The Shining. And why he is doing this is it's embedding in your subconscious mind this endless reincarnation cycle going on inside the Overlook. Another interesting theme, and this is something I talk about in Cinema Symbolism, is the whole notion of the Overlook Hotel being sort of this dark, ostentatious representation of the United States of America, and where you get this whole idea of this is sort of the dark side of America being the sort of what in alchemy you would call the negredo, the blackening, dark representation of the United States. And of course, this is symbolized in the movie with the Overlook being built on the Indian burial ground. And of course, the idea is the symbolism with it is that the United States was built upon the Native American nations, and you have that with the Overlook being this very ostentatious place. I mean, Ullman says, you know, only the best people hang out here, you know, movie stars, presidents, royalty, and the whole idea is that the Overlook is sort of this dark representation of the United States, and it's being, you know, being having the destroyer of the Native American cultures. And you'll find this this, you know, when you go into Allman's office, he has the little American flag sitting on his desk. His clothing is actually red, white, and blue. Pay attention to when Danny and Danny and Shelley Duvall, Wendy, are eating breakfast. It's the color scheme of their clothing is red, white, and blue, symbolizing the United States flag. So, you know, and even at one point in time when they get to the Overlook, they actually say this. Shelley Duvall's clothing, again, is red, white, and blue. And this is right before when they go into the hedge mage. They refer to the Overlook. They say, you know, loser has to clean up all the garbage or something. You will find trash cans in around the Overlook with American flags on them. And the little boy says something back to her saying, we got to keep America clean. And she says, yeah, that's right. We got to keep America clean. The implication that the Overlook is symbolizing the United States. So, I mean, intentionally done, absolutely. Kubrick's a master of it. The Shining is a great movie anyway. I love it. I think it's a phenomenal film, but it's a great movie to dissect symbology. Just a ton of repetition. I'm scratching the surface with it. Right. Loads of repetition, loads of numbers going on, a lot of symbolism. It's something I touched on in Cinema Symbolism, and I'm taking on more in depth in Cinema Symbolism too.
Now, did he include any of this type of symbolism in 2001?
Well, 2001 was based on, you will definitely find some symbolism going on with that, though, but I think he definitely stays more true to the Arthur C. Clarke, you know, storyline with that. But, I mean, you definitely have some symbolism going on in that. I mean, this also ties into The Shining with, you know, if you want to see the apotheosis of mankind, mankind being elevated to a godlike status, it's clearly 2001. Right. And then you have the flip opposite in The Shining, which is mankind delving into madness and insanity and murder, which is The Shining. So you have the apotheosis of mankind in 2001. You have the degradation of mankind in The Shining. And then you have the whole idea, and this is something I touch on in Cinema Symbolism, is the whole idea of the monoliths, you know, being sort of this representation of these, you know, what I tie to, you know, the trilithon stones of places like Stonehenge and these stone circles and these stone monuments, which are sort of, you know, here on Earth, the idea of the trilithon stones being sort of these keepers of this lost esoteric, potentially extraterrestrial history that we're not aware of. And of course, you have this with the monoliths, sort of this, you know, these keepers of this universal understanding, the origins of mankind, the origins of the universe being kept in the, you know, locked away with the mysteries of the monoliths in 2001 and the subsequent sequels. So you have this whole notion with the monoliths in the Arthur C. Clarke novels, and of course they turn up in the movies as well as sort of the keepers of this esoteric, universal, lost, you know, origins of mankind in the universe. And you can't help but notice the parallels with these trilithon stones. I mean, when you watch it, it's immediately what, at least to me anyway, jumps into your head is these, you know, massive trilithon stones and these stone structures, you know, whether it be Stonehenge, Göbekli Tepe, what have you, being sort of these lost, being representations of those lost, you know, civilization, you know, history of mankind that we're still trying to figure out here.
So what I heard about Eyes Wide Shut is it wasn't quite the movie he wanted to make.
Well, there's the Eyes Wide Shut is an interesting movie. There's so much that goes on in that. It's one of those movies. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's stories around that there are scenes that were cut out with it because Warner Brothers, you know, he was revealing too much. The movie was ultimately released. And you know, of course, the idea is that, you know, this is what got Kubrick killed, was that he was releasing, you know, too much information. Clearly, if you ask me, you know, about a movie, you know, the Illuminati in film, that would certainly be one of the ones that would be in the top three is Eyes Wide Shut. And again, there's clear intention with Kubrick, what he does in this movie to convey this. and you know whether there are deleted scenes or whatever, and it was. I mean, I've heard people, you know, come on. I mean, I know that Arleigh Emery, who was the drill sergeant in the military movie he made, Full Metal Jacket. Mm. He said right after the movie came out, he said he had a phone conversation with Kubrick, and Kubrick was very displeased with the way the movie came out. Alternatively, there was someone who I can't remember who it was. I think it may have been someone else in that movie, maybe Vincent D'Onofrio. I can't recall. Kubrick had a conversation with him, and Kubrick said he was very pleased with the way the movie came out. So there's conflicting information about this. But what I can tell you is, with Eyes Wide Shut, is again, this is a movie that Kubrick is using symbolism, and he's using it intentionally. And I think, you know, I have the movie here. I've watched it numerous times. And again, this is a movie that I'm talking about in cinema symbolism too, but I certainly don't mind delving into it with you. Is the movie to me is, I mean, this is just me watching it just as a film critic and as a fan and on a symbolic level. The movie is, I think, intentionally boring, and I think Kubrick is doing that on purpose. And I think the reason that he's doing that is he's conveying to the person watching it. I think he's really, what he's saying is, if you watch this movie just on a non-symbolic level, you're probably not going to get a lot of out of it. But if you watch it on a symbolic level, you're going to understand what I'm trying to tell you here. So the movie to me is intentionally boring, if that makes sense. And I think he's doing that, and he's saying if you just watch it through a sort of nondescript lens, a profane lens, you're not going to like it. But if you put on your symbolic goggles, you're going to understand a lot. You know, you're going to understand what I'm trying to tell you in this movie. And I mean, it's clearly, you have the whole idea of society, you know, modern day society, is sort of being tormented by these petty evils, whether it be drug abuse, prostitution, infidelity, and you know, he sets the movie at Christmas time, and every time, you know, I mean, he just overloads every scene with these gaudy Christmas lights in the background, you know, whether it be the prostitute's den, the drug den, where, or, you know, the scene where the Russian guy's trying to pimp his daughter. It's just these gaudy, gaudy Christmas lights in the background. I mean, he's doing that on purpose. What Kubrick is telling you symbolically is these evils, these are petty. Nothing compared to when then you get to this quasi, you know, Illuminati, Masonic, quote-unquote, OTO temple. And of course, when you get there, when you get inside the castle, we have no Christmas lights. We are devoid of Christmas. We are outside of society at that point. And what Kubrick is showing you symbolically is, okay, you know, this is nothing compared to the petty evils that torment society, what these guys are into, you know, with these sex magic Illuminati rituals, you know, the manipulators of society, you know, which eventually comes out at the end of the movie with Sidney Pollack, where Pollack basically tells Tom Cruise at the end, you know, these are the guys, these are the puppet masters, what you stumbled into, you know, and these people can kill you at will, essentially. And you know, the evils, the drug abuse, the prostitution, the infidelity, the drug, you know, the drug use, all, you know, all this stuff that he shows you around the Christmas lights, this is nothing compared to what these guys are into. And that's really the symbolic lesson, I think, that Kubrick is putting on inside Eyes Wide Shut. It's an interesting movie, and it's something that I'm taking on in the book I'm writing right now, Cinema Symbolism 2.
I actually always enjoyed that one a lot. I have a question from a listener, Steve Ray.
Sure.
First of all, he said 101 is binary for 5.
For 5, that's right, that's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's right. It's 5, and Neo's the 6th one. That's right.
Okay. And he wanted to know if you had any thoughts on the Gnostic symbolism of something called Super Jail.
What was the name of it?
Super Jail.
You know, it could be Gnostic in nature, but I've never seen the movie, so I wouldn't. I wanted to comment on a movie I haven't seen. I'm not saying it's there or it isn't. I'm just saying I haven't seen it, and not seeing it, that's right. I couldn't answer a question on a movie I haven't seen.
Okay, it looks like it's a TV series, actually.
Yeah, no, to be honest with you, I'm not familiar with it.
Neither am I.
In any way, Yeah, no, in any way, shape, or form. So, unfortunately, I'm going to have to take a pass on that for the time being.
That's fine. And if anyone has any questions they'd like me to pass along to Rob, you can go into our chat room at wheredidtheroadgo.com, and I will pass them along. There's so many here that I want to talk about, but we don't have, 8 hours to do it. What was the... You mentioned an odd one, the Smurfs.
Oh, yeah, the Smurfs is... I delve into this with more of the TV comic book theme. It's something I talk about. It's actually something I talk about in the very beginning of Cinema Symbolism. And the whole idea was why I introduced the Smurfs is, for starters, you will find this material in children's shows as well. Children can be influenced by this as well. But it's interesting, the Smurfs are a very deep political allegory. And you will find this also in the Wizard of Oz movie. The Smurfs themselves are this, it's communism. It's communism versus, you can look at, the Smurfs are this perfected communist society. And then you can look at Gargamel as either, you can look at him as one of two ways. You can look at him as either the decadent West, the United States, the archenemy of the communist post-Cold War, or you can look at Gargamel as Nazi Germany, the World War II enemies of the communists. So you have the Smurfs who live in this perfect communist society, socialist society. They all live rent-free. They all work according to their specified job, what they're experts at. They all wear the exact same clothing, and they all live in the exact same type of housing. And then you have Papa Smurf, who, of course, wears the red of the communists. And not only that, he has the actual red cap, the little Phrygian cap of the French revolutionaries. These are the sans-culottes, the French revolutionaries. These are the proto-Marxists, as it were. And if you actually look at Papa Smurf, Papa Smurf's physical appearance is actually modeled after Karl Marx, of all things. Hmm. So you have the Smurfs living in this perfected communist society. You have the character of Gargamel. You can look at him as one of two ways. You can look at him as the materialistic West, who is trying to destroy the Smurfs. When Gargamel was first introduced, we know he's into materialism because the very first time he's introduced, he's trying to perfect the Philosopher's Stone, to perfect alchemy, to transmute base metal into gold. And then you could also look at Gargamel as sort of this dark representation of Nazi Germany. I mean, Gargamel is dressed in the black. This conjures, of course, the SS, Heinrich Himmler, who was into the occult. You have Gargamel being into alchemy, black magic, has the little castle keep there, the hovel, and down in his basement he has the Grand Book of Spells. And you can look at Gargamel as sort of this, really dark black magician. I know it's a kid's show, but you have Gargamel. He actually creates a Kabbalistic golem, a Frankenstein-like monster. This is Smurfette. A lot of people aren't aware that Smurfette is originally a creation of Gargamel. What the purpose of Smurfette is, he sends her into the perfected communist society to destroy it from within. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And what happens is he takes a lump of clay and he uses black magic, satanic magic, for lack of a better word, and he imbues the lump of clay with human life to create this golem, a Frankenstein-like monster. Smurfette goes into the village, creates all kind of discord. Papa Smurf catches word of this, that there's this creature named Smurfette running around causing problems, and then Papa Smurf uses the white magic to transform Smurfette into the Smurfette with the blonde hair and the white high heels. This is the Smurfette, that eventually becomes welcomed into the communist society. So he thwarts Gargamel's plan there. The purpose of all this was, I wanted to talk about, in the movie I get into some of the deeper political allegories of the Wizard of Oz movie. So I wanted to introduce the whole notion of politics being veiled in movies and cinema and TV shows and comics and things like that, and the Smurfs are a great example of it. I know Walt Disney gets brought into this mix also, but the Smurfs really, really have a lot going on in them. And it was something I did introductory in the at the very beginning of the at the book. So yeah, I mean, it's something I mentioned in Cinema Symbolism. It's an interesting study, and it kind of laid the groundwork for some of this later on in the book.
All right. I never even would have thought to look at the Smurfs like that, honestly. Another one that I didn't really think of as being heavily symbolic would be the James Bond films.
Oh, the James Bond stuff is fantastic. And again, this comes out of the world of you can't make this stuff up. Ian Fleming, the guy who produced the James Bond stories, the actual novels, he worked in World War II. He worked in British intelligence against the Nazis. And he was in British intelligence, MI5, MI6, counterintelligence. Mm-hmm. And one of the characters that was actually under him, who was a spy for the British government, both in World War I and World War II, was none other than Aleister Crowley,
right.
The magician, you know, the Masonic, you know, esoteric, you know, sexual magician, as it
right.
were. And you have this very, you know, esoteric, hermetic impact upon Fleming, via Crowley onto Fleming. And I mean, just right off the bat, you have the whole notion, and this has been well documented. I talk about it in the book. The whole 007 sigil, 007, is a reference to this Elizabethan magus, an astrologer, court magician named Dr. John Dee, who back in Elizabethan times created this form of sorcery called Enochian magic. And John Dee served as a spy. Excuse me, with Queen Elizabeth's, with his spy ring created by Sir Francis Walsingham. And Dee used to, when he wrote an espionage correspondent, whether he was, you know, in the Holy Roman Empire hanging around with Rudolf II, he used to sign the correspondent 007, 007. And it was actually meant to look like eyeglasses. It was two circles with a line over them, then a line down the side. And the idea was, the symbolism was that he was her eyes in the field and that the correspondence was for her eyes only, which is, again, another term you'll find in modern-day espionage. And Fleming was very impressed with this, so he made James Bond 007 as this esoteric reference to this earlier English spy master and occultist John Dee. And again, you know, just the James Bond stories, by and large, are very alchemical. I mean, you have, you know, very esoteric. You have the stories are all the same. You have this sort of what the Rosicrucians and the secret societies call the, you know, alchemical union of the sun and moon, you know, the masculine with the feminine. You know, in the Bond stories, it's the unification of Bond with the Bond girl. And this, of course, you know, this occurs just about in every one of the Bond stories. This spiritually equips Bond to then go on and defeat, you know, these over the top villains, whether it be the alchemist or Goldfinger, who's trying to transmute gold, you know, the dragon Hugo Drax, you know, the Illuminist Ernst Stavro Blofeld, who runs Spectre, which is this secret global organization trying to take over the world. You get into the idea of Bond getting the sacred wisdom. In the Bond stories, it's always this miraculous gadget from this Hermes Trismegistus like wizard named Q, and this, of course, always winds up saving Bond's life. So you have these very hermetic, esoteric themes going on inside the James Bond stories. I mean, you know, you have the whole one with the voodoo, the live and let die story, I mean, which is very occult in nature, just by, even on the surface, it's very esoteric. You have themes of alchemy in Goldfinger. The James Bond chapter is probably one of my favorites in the cinema book. I have a whole chapter on it with Crowley, John Dee, all that good stuff. And that really does. The whole occult world of Ian Fleming, that's one you can't make up. It's a fascinating study.
Now, does that continue on the latest films as well?
Yeah, I mean, even you know, I mean, you have a lot of the Bond stories are based upon the stories by Fleming, and then even later on, you know, once they ran out of the Bond stories, a lot of the James Bond stories, the modern ones, are just retellings of the earlier ones, just under new names. They're just rehashes. That's absolutely true. Where it's just the same story, just with different characters and a different plot twist. And now even the one that's about to come out, I mean, Spectre. This was the Ian Fleming Illuminati or type organization, this hidden hand that controlled both the East and the West, or worked with them but against them. And you know, you had the Illuminati, you know, master Ernst Stavro Blofeld, who was secretly trying to take over the world. Of course, this is probably most famously played by Donald Pleasence. You Only Live Twice is probably the best movie to see Spectre in action. And the Spectre has a meaning that stands for Special Executive Command. No, excuse me. Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, Extortion was what Spectre stood for. I'm sure that we're going to find this hidden hand hard at work in this latest movie that's about to come out.
Hmm. All right. And I think appropriately right now we should get into the Back to the Future trilogy, because part two, we're right about the time period that Marty would have arrived.
Yeah, that's right. It would have been, what, October 21st, 2015? The Back to the Future movies are a massive undertaking. I'll get into it as briefly as I can. You're dealing with a ton of mythology and numerology in the Back to the Future movies. There's some really fun stuff going on in those movies. The Back to the Future movies was, again, this was another one of my favorite chapters to talk about, or to write about, excuse me, because the Back to the Future trilogy is one of those series of movies that is, you wouldn't expect to find anything, but is actually overloaded with esoteric themes and mythology. And again, it's one of those trilogies that has so much going on in it. You know, you are well beyond coincidence. This is just a massive undertaking. I'm just going to hint on some of this stuff. You have an entire retelling of the Egyptian Osirian cycle mythology in this, where you have the solar family of George, Lorraine, and Marty living in Lion Estate. That's a reference to Leo the Lion, which is the soul house of the sun. You have Marty as this sort of solar hero. Comparative religion, this is Apollo or Horus, and they ride around. Apollo drives around in the sun chariot, which is, of course, the DeLorean. And I'm just going into this incredibly quickly because, I mean, there's just so much to it. I mean, even in the next 20 minutes, I'd just be scratching the surface. But you have the whole idea of the sun chariot being activated by solar fire. How's that done? This is lightning striking the clock tower at 10:04. 10:04 is an esoteric reference to October 4th, which is the 277th day of the Gregorian solar calendar, which means there are 88 days left. This is why the sun chariot, the DeLorean, has to be activated at 88 miles an hour. You have the arch enemy of the sun family in Egyptian mythology. This was a character called Typhon. This turns up as Biff Tannen. The names are all but phonetically the same. So you have this entire retelling of this Egypt. You have the idea of George McFly being this Osiris father figure who is killed and resurrected in part two by Typhon Tannen. And then, of course, Osiris is eventually resurrected, and you have this happening in part two where Lorraine, who would sort of be the Isis figure, and Marty, who would be the Horus figure, work in tandem to go back in time to bring Osiris George back to life. Believe me, this is completely played out on screen when you understand it, and you understand some of the numerology going on inside this movie and some of the comparative religion. I delve into it much more than I can get into right now on the phone, but this whole thing plays out in Back to the Future. It's not a coincidence that this is going on. Kubrick wreaks all kind of havoc with this material. I mean, and again, some other symbolism and themes that are going on in this. On a lesser level, you have the very beginning of the Back to the Future movie is the actual ending of it, when Back to the Future opens, you're panning Doc Brown's timepieces. If you pay attention to this very carefully, you'll find the little man hanging off one of the clock hands, and it's actually dressed as Doc Brown from the past. And this, of course, is referencing the very end of the movie where Brown's hanging off the clock face in order to harness the lightning to get Marty back to 1985. And you also find another timepiece of a wino lifting a bottle of wine up to his mouth. And again, this is representing Reds, the local drunk, at the very end of the movie. I mean, then finally you get to Doc Brown's alarm clock, which kicks on, and you'll hear an ad for Statler Toyota dealership. this turns up all over the place in the Back to the Future movies. Statler Toyota dealership is actually, it turns up at the end of the movie again. This is where Marty gets his 4x4 from, which he sees earlier in the movie. You'll see a sign over that says another 4x4 from Statler Toyota. And the ad on the alarm clock is, it says October is inventory month at Statler Toyota dealership. So the beginning of Back to the Future is actually the end of the movie. Zemeckis wreaks all kind of, of course, this ties in. It's Back to the Future. I mean, right? So we're going to start with the end. We're going to go literally back to the future at the very beginning of the movie. Statler Toyota dealership turns up again and again throughout the trilogy. In part three, when Marty goes back to Hill Valley, which is an oxymoron, by the way, to 1885, the first thing he sees is a sign that says, Honest Joe Statler, horses bought, sold, and traded. Obviously, this is an ancestor of the guy who owns the Toyota dealership. And another thing, and this is something else that Zemeckis and Spielberg love to wreak havoc with, is the placement of buildings in the Back to the Future world. They always have this dualistic, paradoxical meaning. And again, this is a theme of the whole series, is creating these paradoxes through time travel, alternative universes, where in 1985, when Marty gets the little notice about Save the Clock Tower, the woman's standing in front of this shop called the Third Eye. It's a fortune teller. And if you pay attention to this, in 1985, it's a building that can see the future, or where you can have your fortune told. When Marty in part two goes to 2015, which is where, like you said, where we are now, that's the exact same building is Blast to the Past, which is where Marty buys the sports almanac. So in the future, it houses relics of the past. In the past, it sees the future. Zemeckis and Spielberg wreak all kind of havoc with this. I delve into it much more in depth in the book. But the Back to the Future movies are one of those series of movies that you wouldn't expect to see a lot going on in them, but they're overloaded with esoteric themes and mythology and hidden symbolism and numerology.
All right. So something maybe you probably haven't covered in the books yet, since it's fairly new, but did you pay attention to Mr. Robot when it aired?
I'm sorry, what's the name of it?
Mr. Robot.
Is it a TV show?
Yes,
or?
It was a TV show. It was similar in a lot of ways to Fight Club.
Well, Fight Club, I know Fight Club has a lot going on in it, a lot of Gnostic themes as well. But no, I've never seen Mr. Robot. Again, this is something I'd have to check out. So not seeing it is something that, I'd be reluctant to comment on.
Right. No, that's fine. Let's get into Fight Club then.
Oh, another classic. One of my all-time favorite movies. Released 1999 was a banner year for Gnostic movies. It came out the same year as the first Matrix movie. And you have just a ton going on inside this thing. You have some very Gnostic themes going on. It's the same as in the Matrix. In Fight Club, you have the idea of the destruction of the material world by this select group of followers, people who have shrugged off materialism to live in poverty. And of course, this in Fight Club is the space monkeys. You'll find this in the Matrix again. This is the same notion of the people who have shrugged off the materialism, the decadence of the material world, the false reality, to live in a state of poverty aboard the Nebuchadnezzar. And you have Neo as the chosen savior. That's right. I mean, 101 is the number 5, and that makes Neo the 6th iteration, as the person correctly pointed out earlier in the show. This follows the idea of a select group of people shrugging off materialism to live in poverty, to seek spiritual gnosis. And of course, this is what the space monkeys in Fight Club are doing, is they're following what I call the spiritual exercises of Tyler Durden, which is the breakdown of oneself, both physically and mentally, to obtain spiritual enlightenment. This follows the Gnostic teachings of a Gnostic philosopher known as Valentinius, who taught this exact same thing, the disregard of materialism for spiritual gnosis, the pursuit of esoteric wisdom. So you have in Fight Club, you have this all-male secret society who are trying to destroy the material world and embrace spiritualism. This is straight out of the world of Valentinius. And then you have this whole idea of this sort of Masonic secret society theme going on inside of a Fight Club as well. You have this all-male secret group who are working behind the scenes of society, and of course I'm a Mason, so Masons get charged with this all the time. And you have the secret Masonic temple there on Paper Street, where you have to stand outside of your own free will in order to gain admission to be initiated into the mysteries of Fight Club. You got to stand on the front porch for 3 days without encouragement. The 3 days represents the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, and it's interesting because the guy in Freemasonry who guards the outside of the Masonic temple is known as the Tyler of all things. So we have Tyler Durden, guarding the entrance of the mysteries of Fight Club. And again, it's an all-male secret society. So we have this sort of Gnostic Masonic theme going on inside of Fight Club. More Gnostic than Masonic per se, but you definitely have that Masonic element going on inside of it. And then, of course, the whole theme is the destruction of the material world in favor of spiritual gnosis. And again, this is symbolized at the very end. And again, you have the unification of the male and female, the masculine and the feminine, the sun and moon. And again, this is a main tenet, this dualistic tenet of the Gnostic religion. In the world of secret societies, this is what's known as the alchemical wedding, also known as the alchemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, the legendary founder of another secret group called the Rosicrucians. So and at the very end of The Matrix, you have the destruction of the two buildings, so the buildings come down, the end of the material world in favor of spiritual gnosis. I love Fight Club, a very Gnostic movie, like The Matrix movie. They both came out at the same year, a banner year for the teachings of Valentinius, as it were.
Yeah, and those are two of my favorite movies, too.
Oh, me too. Oh, they're great films. Absolutely.
I mean, just because of all that, it just adds another element of depth to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's you watch the movie and you like it anyway, but then when you understand these deeper meanings that these authors and these filmmakers a lot of times that make the movies off of this, it really makes you appreciate the movie more. At least I think it does. And I know there is a body of thought out there that this is all Illuminati, MK Ultra mind control. I mean, I don't really see it that way at all. I think it just adds a much deeper level. And it's a challenge to find this material out. And I think for me, at any rate, writing this book, I mean, I for me coming out of it, I just had a much more deeper appreciation of these films than I did beforehand. I mean, and again, you pick up on these esoteric themes, you find the context of what the movie's about, and you can start dissecting it. You will find this entire esoteric symbolic treasure trove going on inside these movies, and it for me, at any rate, has led to this greater appreciation of these films that were great anyway, but are just spectacular now.
And I guess the last one we should get to is also kind of timely, as the next part is coming out in December, and that would be the Star Wars movies.
Oh my goodness gracious! Yeah, I mean, my God, that was quite a challenge in cinema symbolism. I did all six of the Star Wars movies, both trilogies, 4, 5, and 6, and then 1, 2, and 3, and both of them are just overloaded with esoteric themes. Lucas is an expert at this. The first, I'll just delve into this again. This is a topic that I could spend another hour talking on, but I'll try to go into this as quickly as I can and just hit on some salient points. Lucas was inspired by an American mythologist and symbolist known as Joseph Campbell was his name. And Campbell wrote this, I guess his magnum opus is this book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And this details this this epic grand journey, which he called the monomyth. And what it was, and this ties into also the world of Carl Jung, the idea of the archetypes and these archetypical adventures. And the hero of a thousand faces that he's talking about is what you would want to call the solar archetype, the solar man, the solar hero, the solar savior. This is, of course, Luke Skywalker. This is Neo Anderson. This is Frodo Baggins. You know, this is Harry Potter. This is the character charged with the savior figure, the character who's going to save the world, save the universe, save Middle Earth from the dark, evil wizard, you know, figure archetype. And so what Campbell talked about in this book was that this hero went on this archetypical adventure, and during this adventure, certain things happened to him, or her in certain instances. The female character, the female architect, the female heroine, is hard to find, but she does exist. And one of the best examples of the solar female heroine, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm. The TV show much more than the movie, and the TV show is something also I dissect. That there's a ton going on in that as well. But going back to Star Wars, so we have Luke Skywalker as the solar hero. I mean, we have the name Luke coming from the Latin lux, meaning light. Skywalker, what light walks across the sky, the sun. This is again Apollo, and Apollo, who's Apollo's sister? The moon, Diana. So who's Luke Skywalker's sister, Princess Leia? You know, what does she wear? The white robes of the moon. You know, Luke Skywalker does battle with the dark evil lord. We talked about this character in the back in terms of comparatively, in comparative religion, being known as Typhon, which is Biff Tannen in the Back to the Future movies. Typhon was its Greek name. In the Egyptian religion, this character was known as Set, or Seth. So we have the Sith lords in Star Wars, who are the dark evil lords. And we have this whole idea, this is what you would call Manichaean cosmology, light versus dark, good versus evil. This ties into, Christianity, it's God versus the devil, or Jesus versus the devil. And believe me, you will find a lot of Christ figures in film, and this character being presented as Jesus Christ, Death and Resurrection with Neo Anderson, Trials and Tribulations, a feminine figure who only believes him. You know, this ties into the Mary Magdalene figure. So getting to Star Wars, we have this whole a wizard figure that always comes along and helps this character. In Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell always talked about, he said, when the solar hero, a la Luke Skywalker, begins his great journey, he always meets this wizard figure who seems to know everything, but only doles the information out as piecemeal and will assist the character on his adventure. So we have Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, who is the wizard. We have Albus Dumbledore in Harry Potter. And of course, we have Gandalf the Grey in the Lord of the Rings. I mean, these characters all look look alike. It's the same figure. It's the old Greybeard. Yeah, it's the old Greybeard who knows everything and only doles it out piecemeal. You know, Dumbledore knows the secret about Harry Potter's scar. You know, Kenobi knows the secret about Darth Vader and who he really is. Gandalf knows the truth about the ring and Sauron and things like that, but will only tell it piecemeal. So you have this whole thing going on inside of Star Wars, this grand monomyth. I tie in the elements with this, with the first three. But then you get into the next three, and I'll just hint on this briefly. You have some very esoteric things going on in that. One of the things Lucas does in the first movie, in the Phantom Menace movie, we've talked in the show about esoteric symbolism. You also have esoteric casting in that movie. The woman, you have in the first movies this whole idea of Anakin Skywalker being the chosen one, of being this Jesus Christ savior figure who's going to save the Jedi Temple. And of course, Anakin Skywalker is virgin birth, we get this from his mother when Liam Neeson questions her about this. She says there is no father, he just happened. So we know Anakin Skywalker is a virgin birth savior, and it's interesting because this is no coincidence. The actress who plays Shmi Skywalker, that's Anakin's mother. That same year that movie came out was 1999. This was a banner year when The Phantom Menace came out. She played the actress who played Shmi Skywalker, name is Pernella August. She played the Virgin Mary, of all things, in a made-for-TV movie that year called Mary, the Mother of Jesus. Huh. So we have this entire nexus of Lucas casting this woman who played the Virgin Mary to play the Virgin Mother of Anakin Skywalker. The story of Anakin Skywalker parallels Jesus Christ. I mean, he's virgin birth. He wants to use power, occult powers, to stop people from dying. He's rejected by the temple elders. He storms the temple. There are all kind of I delve into it much more in the book, but there are all kind of parallels between Anakin Skywalker and Jesus Christ. The virgin birth is but one, and the casting of this woman is Lucas's way of telling you this. The Star Wars movie was a massive undertaking inside cinema symbolism. Check it out inside the book. I get into it in much more detail inside the book.
Do you think we'll see it continue on the new one now that Lucas doesn't have his hands into it?
Oh, I can't imagine we won it. I haven't seen any of these new movies. Like you said, the new one comes out in December. These are being put out by Walt Disney. The Disney movies, a lot of these contain esoteric themes in them as well. A lot of the Walt Disney movies, I'm taking one inside Cinema Symbolism too. Mm. The two National Treasure movies were put out by Walt Disney. And the first National Treasure movie, well, both National Treasure movies, I took on inside the Royal Arch of Enoch book, but the first National Treasure movie is actually a Masonic ritual. That's actually the Royal Arch ceremonial. That's the recovery of the treasure vault, the Masonic treasure vault, in the subterranean vault beneath the Holy Ground. So if you actually want to see a Masonic ritual on screen, it's Walt Disney's National Treasure. And this carries these exact same themes forward in National Treasure 2. The fact that these are now being put out by Walt Disney would not necessarily preclude esoteric symbolism. In fact, I would hope and think that these next three movies, yes, I would say, will have some sort of esoteric themes. I can't guarantee it though until I see them, of course.
And J.J. Abrams is obviously no stranger to this.
No.
Yeah, to putting symbolism and stuff.
And you can't help but think, I mean, at some point in time, I mean, my God, you're dealing with Han Solo, Luke Skywalker. I mean, you can't tell me that that George Lucas isn't going to have some influence some way or another on these films. I can't believe that.
I guess we'll see how it all comes out in December.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm hopeful. I didn't like the second three films at all. I like what Abrams did with Star Trek, and I like a lot of his TV series. So,
I liked. I thought Phantom Menace was boring. I thought Attack of the Clones, I didn't think was too bad. I like Sith, but I did. You know, I think my kind of attitude was, I think Attack of the Clones probably should have been part one, and then Sith should have been part two, and then they should have done a third one more with Darth Vader for part three. I didn't really need to see Anakin Skywalker running around as a little boy.
Yeah.
You know, on Tatooine, kind of boring. You know, and then of course Jar Jar Binks, you know, will just drive you crazy with this thing.
All right, where can people find you online?
Yeah. Well. Again, thank you for having me on your show tonight. Where did the road go? I mean, where did the time go? It was a great show. Thank you so much for having me on. If you're interested in my books, Royal Arch of Enoch, I know you know, we'll have to come back and do a show on that.
Yes.
And Cinema Symbolism, of course. The easiest way to find these books and find me online is my website. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. So my website is just that. It's www. This is all lowercase, all connected. Robert W. Sullivan with two L's, and then it's the letter I, the letter V, as in the Roman numerals for four. Robert W. Sullivan IV.com. Again, that's www.robertwsullivaniv.com. There are links there to purchase the books. That you can get the paperbacks. You can get the ebooks, are much cheaper. They're on Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, Cinema Symbolism. Both books are in ebook formats. You can get the paperbacks, but they're going to cost you a little bit more. And from my website, you can go to my YouTube channel and listen to other podcasts and TV shows I've done, watch some TV. You can find me on Twitter and follow me there. You can, there are Facebook fan pages for both my books, Royal Arch and Cinema Symbolism. It's all there. The page is very easy to navigate. There's more information about me, biography there, information about the books, information on how to purchase the books. www.robertwsullivaniv.com. Check it out. Loads of material there.
And when does Cinema Symbolism 2 come out?
Well, I'm actually writing that right now. I'm actually writing that in my first work of fiction. These are being done simultaneously. I would think probably these books should be wrapping up in the next six months or so. So there's going to be, you know, they just don't come out. You know, they got to go through phases and formatting and all that. So hopefully, probably in about a year's time, I'm looking for both these books. You know, that's roughly both Cinema Symbolism 2 and my first work of fiction should be out.
Is your first work of fiction going to be just loaded with symbolism?
Well, it's fiction, so you know it does have a couple esoteric things in that. I don't want to give away too much, but no, I've got some little esoteric themes going on inside of that. We'll see if people pick up on it, and see where that takes me. But yeah, there is some veiled stuff going on inside that story. Oh, of course, I mean I'd have to come
right. On. And what kind of story is it? Sci-fi?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. No, I'm glad you asked me about it because no one really has. It's a story. It takes place in England. It's a story about a witch's coven in modern times. It deals with witchcraft, demonism, secret societies, all kind of good stuff. Conspiracy, has some erotic themes in it as well. All kind of good stuff. I threw everything in but the kitchen sink. yeah, witchcraft, demonism. Secret societies, all that good stuff.
Wow, sounds interesting. Maybe we'll have to have you on to talk a little bit about that too at some point when it comes out.
Yeah, what I'm planning on doing was, I don't know if I can do a whole show on a work of fiction, so my motivation was, if I release Cinema Symbolism 2 and then did this work of fiction, maybe, you know, if I did a show, I could do like 45 minutes on the new movies and then spend like the last 10 minutes talking about the work of fiction. That was sort of my motivation behind all this.
All right, well, I look forward to both of them, and I thank you for being on. We're actually going to end with something off Psyche Corporation's Crypts and Codes, appropriately enough. This is Worrying World. We'll see you next week.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Number 1597 and counting. Can you hear?